Good morning, folks, and thank you very much for attending the day two of the Barclays Global Technology Conference. My name is Amir Rozwadowski, and I actually head up our U.S. Telecom Services Research Practice. One of the consistent themes that we've been hearing about over the technology industry over the last several years is the growing influence of connectivity and its ability to enable various types of technology, both mobile and fixed line. At the core of providing this type of connectivity has, of course, been AT&T, both with providing increased amounts of connectivity in broadband through its U-verse and Gigapower initiatives, as well as on a wide area network with the deployment of high-capacity LTE. Thus, it's with great pleasure that we have with us today John Donovan, Senior EVP, AT&T Technology and Operations. And thank you very much, John, for joining us here today.
Thank you, Amir.
In terms of, one of the things that we've been talking about from a...
Before you jump in,
yeah.
Can I put the safe harbor statement up?
Yeah,
and just remind everybody to take a quick look at that, and then remind you and everybody else that I won't be able to take any questions on spectrum auctions because it's in that quiet period.
Of course. Thank you very much.
Is that okay?
That's fine with me. I suspect that there'll be others in the audience that may be a touch disappointed, but we'll work through that.
Yeah. As you know, that I'm not afraid to say no.
Very much.
And no is a complete sentence, too. Yeah.
It is. So, if we think about sort of AT&T's spending priorities over the next 12 to 24 months, how should we think about where your priorities are in order to ensure that you continue to remain competitive in the current environment?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of ways to think about how you would answer the question. You often think about it by platform, either wireless or wireline, or by brand name, Gigapower and fiber to the curb and all that. But from the standpoint of the planning of the network, our primary objective and our biggest capital goes towards reliability. We have to give our marketing partners in the business a differentiation in the marketplace. And so, having been where we were in the early days of the iPhone, we really have clawed our way back into having the premier network across the board. And so our primary objective will always be the quality and the capacity that's needed to keep that network as the premier network out there, and that gives our marketing folks the ability to go do things. So that's the primary investment. The second one, as far as an area that is growing in importance, is just the internal transformation that we're doing around software definition, whether that's in the wide area network, whether that's the IT environment. As we virtualize and automate, we gain more and more internal efficiencies, whether that's ability to do customer self-service, whether it's the digital-first way that we channelize. We're really going through a tremendous transformation, really from a hardware company to a software company, and that's an area that we have to maintain our investment priority. And then the third bucket, as I think about it, is really footprint, whether the footprint is to take fiber into the places that into more cities, whether that's to move more ADSL into VDSL, to just throw some technology buzzwords out there. There's the evolution every year of our network where we can either the electronics got cheaper, the labor got cheaper, or we found a new way, and there's more and more of those cases every year that you evaluate and say, hey, these are really good NPVs now, and maybe last year they weren't, but with the new way that we can view the world, they would be. So that's how I think about it. Top priority is quality, capacity, then the transformation that we're making internally, and then footprint.
Fantastic. So if we can dive in a bit on those sort of three buckets, if we look at reliability, what type of technology investments do you think are needed in order to ensure consistent reliability? And how do you, there's a lot of discussions out there by many of your peers on reliability versus speed versus bandwidth capacity. And how should we think about the different moving pieces when it comes to your decision-making process on the type of investments that you're making from a network perspective?
Yeah. Well, let's start on the wireless network. On the wireless network, the LTE network is playing extremely well, not in the eyes of people who build networks, but in the customers themselves. So if you look at customer satisfaction, Net Promoter Score, The LTE network is the preferred network. When we get customers on there, they're happier. It's the most efficient use of spectrum that I've got today to deploy. It's also, you know, the most economical thing that we can do. And so one of the very, very important things we're doing as a technology organization in conjunction with marketing is to just continue the migration of our customers off the 2G network and try to leapfrog them to LTE, and then we're going to try to take them from the HSPA Plus network to the LTE network. And that frees up spectrum and allows us to mine spectrum and run that play. And it also works really well for customer satisfaction. And so in the wireless network, that evolution is an important part of what we're doing. And then I'll add a second one on the wireless network is we're starting to focus a lot on the platforms that allow us to build what are often called the fourth wave of wireless service. You go from voice to text to data and apps, and now you're starting to look at lifestyle stuff like connected cars and, you know, digitizing home automation and so on. And so we're looking at some, you know, platforms to continue to expand that. On the wireline side of the business, there's a really big migration that most enterprises are now going through to virtualization. And, you know, not a lot of people talk about the fact that a cloud strategy where I move all of my data and my applications from my enterprise premise out of the cloud, that requires fat pipes to move that stuff around. And so, you know, the speed up of our network on the enterprise side and a lot of those things, the wireline side of the business has far more action than maybe its top line looks like. There's a massive technology migration going on underneath it.
And then given the type of capital budget that you've been presented, I mean, clearly there's been some shifting around in terms of the outlook for spending for AT&T. Do you feel comfortable in terms of the type of resources that you have available to meet some of these reliability needs? And perhaps you can touch upon here sort of where you stand with Project VIP. I mean, clearly that's
an important issue. Well, yeah, the capital budget itself, I mean, you know, this is a scale business, and so you're always looking to get the best returns you can on capital. It's for, you know, for the longest time now, when you look at Moore's Law and how it applies to your business, you really have to pick, you know, how you land your technologies. As I always tell folks internally, doing nothing saves us 1.5% per month on something that we would buy because Moore's Law works in your favor. So it isn't just about picking the right technology, it's picking the right time and the right technology. And so, you know, we've got a big enough capital budget right now that not only can we handle the new services that we feel very confident we've really, you know, sort of invested in the right ones, but also the efficiency with which we're deploying the capital is getting better and better as a result of, you know, faster cycle times and, you know, more software definition to our network. So as we go more software-based, we get faster and more iterative and then more efficient. So VIP, to the latter part of your question, you know, we've checked a lot of the major boxes off. When you look at that, that was an investment period where, you know, we went LTE and, you know, we crossed over 300 million POPs. We looked at the U-verse footprint, that expansion is complete, and now we're, you know, two-thirds of the way through fiber to more enterprises. And so we're really clipping that thing off, and we're getting really to the small tail on the activity that we're doing there. And so once that you get over that and you have these efficiencies and you have a footprint you're comfortable with, then, yeah, I feel very, very good about where we are in the capital program and the things that we need to get done.
And in terms of, you know, looking forward, you know, the areas where you continue to see sort of investment and the needs for continued investment in order to support network reliability, particularly from a wireless side, you know, are discussions around increased cell density sort of coming top of mind? Is there discussion of increased amount of investment on the small cell side? How should we think about sort of that priority for you folks?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the urban rural is, you know, the first way to think about it. There's still footprint out there that's available, white space, if you will, for, you know, for us, for other carriers. You look at that each year and you see how it looks. But increasingly, it's becoming a dense urban game. Mm-hmm. And we feel very comfortable right now that over the last several years we've made some investments. So our site count and our capacity that we've got in these urban areas, as well as in building. I mean, we were, we were doing multiples of other carriers in the early days of iPhones of in-building solutions, and so that served us very well. And so I think it's going to become more of a densification and urban area game here on the short horizon, and that's really how we've allocated our emphasis within AT&T.
And then, you know, when you talk about network reliability, oftentimes one can imagine that the demands for network reliability change as use cases changes over the mobile network. I mean, certainly the parameters for network reliability in all voice network are different than the parameters in an all data network.
Yeah.
How should we think about the increased use of video and how you sort of look at your network assets today and perhaps where they could go in the future? In terms of delivering a more robust experience on the both wireless and wireline side?
Yeah, well, right now, the in the consumer part of our mobile network, the majority of our traffic is video.
Mm-hmm.
So when we architect the core of our network, it's a video delivery network, and that's what we've got to do. And the challenge is really that when you look at the explosive growth of video on one hand and the growth of Internet of Things that's projected, one of them taxes the data plane and the other one taxes the control plane, and so it's really kind of a challenging, it's an engineering challenge. And so, you know, we've had to fundamentally think differently about how we're going to architect our network to deliver that kind of video. And, you know, as I often say, that applications are like an inert gas and they expand to the size of the pipe, so we don't know what the new applications are going to be. As my labs guys like to say, we can forecast the demand, we just don't know exactly how it's going to show up. It might be ambient video, it could be robotics, it could be, you know, this or it could be that, but given the deployment cycles, you can't be, you know, you sort of have to anticipate some of these shifts. But I think the one for video is profound. It's here, it's cultural, it's bleeding from consumer over into enterprise. You know, I had one enterprise customer told me that they were shocked that it's a large organization. They went out and sort of said, how much video are you guys going to shoot? We want to size our network. And they were stunned to see that next year the forecast is for over 100,000 videos. Huh. From my own standpoint, I recently reorganized and instead of putting an org chart out, I did a video org chart where you click on a box and someone will tell you for 5 minutes what their new organization does and is and how it fits. And that's just the nature of how people now run the processes of the business. So it's becoming extremely pervasive, and, you know, I think we're as ready as we can be, but we need to continue to evolve.
And does the addition of satellite infrastructure sort of help change the game with respect to content delivery and optimizing content delivery for your folks?
Well, yeah, the delivery over satellite is an efficient way to deliver linear video. I can't talk about any particulars related to the merger, but if you just think about contextually, your delivery vehicles, you've got, you know, you have satellite delivery, you have broadband delivery, you have wireless delivery over Wi-Fi and over regulated spectrum, and then you have different lengths of format, and those lengths of format fit the screen sizes. And I think in the future, you really have to contemplate the full range of that solution as people become increasingly mobile. As the content gets shorter in duration, you really have to augment this. People want their content wherever they are.
And then, you know, switching gears onto the wireline side, you know, when thinking about the Gigapower initiative and sort of some of the focus that you folks have increased on that side, are you seeing sort of use cases for that type of capacity that's necessary? Or is this sort of a decision that you're saying, look, there is an opportunity set, people are buying, you know, sort of bandwidth, increased amounts of bandwidth, and quite frankly, it's the returns on these types of investment are attractive, so moving forward here is the right decision.
It's the latter part is more of the logic. The NPV is good and people are buying it. Now, if the pragmatist in me says, are they using it, the answer to that is that there aren't applications out there that require a gig, and also, you know, when we do the installs, we often have to stay and show them on a speed test it's getting a gig, because once they do the same things today they did yesterday, they often find that the source might be the slow portion. Or, you know, so it's, you know, I don't see a lot right now, nor do I see a lot on the imminent horizon, but, you know, customers love speed. They're addicted to speed, and if they're buying it and it's a good NPV and competition's out there with it, then I think it's the right thing for us to do to invest.
What's changed on the NPV perspective that has enabled you to move forward with these types of investments?
Well, I think that in all areas of broadband, it's, you know, it's all of a sudden, a couple of years ago, broadband started to make some technological breakthroughs. And I joined AT&T in 2008, and I remember around 2012 looking at some charts, and the cost of speed hadn't really had a breakthrough because 80% of your deployment in broadband is labor-based. And then all of a sudden, you have, you know, vectoring and small form factor stuff, and all of a sudden, a little bit of investment by our supply chain, a few standards things, and we start to, you know, take a 25 meg on a copper pair, and then we move it to 45, and then 75, and then 100, which is on the drawing board, and you say, wow, all of a sudden, you know, copper extends its life. And the same is happening on fiber as we go from, you know, into technologies like GPON. And then we're getting better at the deployment side of the business as well. And so that heavily labor part of the business, we're getting better and better and better as a result of software. You know, to this earlier question about investment, today when our technicians are dispatched, they carry tablets. And those tablets, because we've abstracted our IT network, you know, we've made 70 process changes for those technicians this year, and frankly, we can do it overnight. They get a tablet, and it tells them, you know, here's what you're going out to do. We have smart systems that kind of look up what's happening in the network, in the home, and it's a smart dispatch. The protocol was built by our best technicians, so our average technician and our best technicians are converging. And so a lot of that kind of technology has afforded us some efficiencies in the labor side of our business, which get better every year. And that's why it's an important area that we continue to invest in.
Fantastic. And then going back on, in terms of the LTE network, you know, I mean, it does seem as though you're gaining a tremendous amount of efficiency when it comes to LTE. How do we think about sort of the, you know, migration and sort of reforming some of that spectrum and the timing to moving towards sort of all IP, all LTE on the wireless side of the equation?
Well, I think that, crazy as it sounds, we still have millions of customers on the 2G network, and some of those customers are, you know, using old flip phones, but then there's others that are machine-to-machine applications. And so we've already announced a shutdown date on that, the December 31st of 2016, and that will free up, you know, 5 to 15 megahertz, depending on the market, of additional spectrum that we can farm in. We'd really like to move that stuff not from 2G into the HSPA+. We'd like to jump it right to LTE. And so the LTE, it's not that complicated, to quote our old commercials. We really need to have, you know, blockbuster devices that people want to go to, and then, you know, the average customer is more focused on the experience than they are on how many G's show up at the top of their smartphone. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to have a good value proposition. And, you know, the trip from 2G to HSPA+, it's 6 to 8 times more efficient. And then the move from HSPA+ to LTE gets you another 50% efficiency or so. So there's, for us, it's a really important play to run, given the spectrum efficiencies that are available.
And then one would also suspect that VoLTE is a key element of this as well, in terms of providing sort of voice connectivity. So how should we think about sort of the deployment and reliability of VoLTE? Because clearly, that is also a question.
Right. You remember the first time you got into an immersive video conference, and you went like this, and it's like, that's a little creepy. High-def voice is like that. I remember, like, it was yesterday. So I called my wife, and she answered the phone, and she said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm in the car." And she said, "Something's wrong. It's like you're right next to me. This is so weird." And then we talked for a little while, and she said, "Actually, it's not like you're next to me. It's like you're inside my head." It is so crystal clear. High-def voice is an extraordinary thing. And so we're excited about VoLTE for the sake of efficiency. The reliability of VoLTE for us it's going to play to our advantage. Our denser network, as a result of, you know, what we went through in the early adoption of smartphones, and the denser grid that we've got, lends itself well to VoLTE, because it's always risky to take your the most important service that you deliver, voice service, and throw it over an IP network where you might have some holes. And so our drop call rates have been extraordinary. By our internal measures, we're ahead of where we thought we would be. I think we're going to have a reliability advantage in VoLTE. And so now it's a question of devices that are capable. Mm-hmm. And that service, you need to have both sides capable in order to get high def. And but it's a wonderful thing.
And then I guess lastly on sort of the LTE front, advanced LTE, carrier aggregation, where are we right now in terms of the ability to efficiently, you know, sort of utilize the broad breadth of your spectrum?
We're well down the path. I mean, I think if you look at each carrier has a unique circumstance in which spectrums they're going to aggregate together. Mm-hmm. And over time, if you take the long term, you know, the low-band spectrum will be your coverage footprint. High-band spectrum is better for carrying large cargo data. And then how you aggregate these things together will determine speed. And so there's a little bit of a penalty when you put the spectrum together, overhead penalty, if you will. And so we're going to do it in different sequences across carriers depending on availability of spectrum. I think our team has done a great job with a spectrum portfolio that has a lot of spectrum across different bands. So I think we stand to gain more than most out there as carrier aggregation goes from 2 to 3 to 4 to infinity. So
in thinking about that, sort of the next generation of networks, I mean, clearly, you know, from LTE, from a global perspective, it's still at early stage of deployment. But
yeah,
we're always
hard to believe. Yeah,
yeah, we're going to ask about 5G, John.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you see sort of the network evolution going from here?
Yeah, how many G's are enough for me? I guess you can't have too many G's. You can't have too much computing power. So, you know, when you look at it from the standpoint of AT&T, mm-hmm. we'd like to see 5G be an air interface leapfrog, right? And so each of the progressions have warranted a refresh cycle mm-hmm. of some sort. And right now, most of the action has moved from the radio network to the core network mm-hmm. to handle this complex Internet of Things and big video explosion. And I think most of the carriers now are doing a pretty good job. Can we benefit from standards? Yes. Can we flatten the network? Yes. Can we reduce components? Yes. But I'm more enthused about making that stuff software-defined than I am next-genning it. And, you know, I'm really kind of pushing towards getting an air interface leapfrog that would allow us to carry more bits per hertz so that we can gain more efficiency in our spectrum. So I don't want you to think that that's a lukewarm response. It's sort of a high bar saying, if you can clear this, then it might make sense to take a look. Absent that, then it's good to sit and talk and plan, but that's not going to trigger any sort of investment cycle.
And so that, I think, provides a great segue into sort of the second bucket that you had mentioned, which is sort of this internal transformation. You know,
yep.
Clearly, if we look at supplier domain 2.0, you know, a lot of change in terms of your expectations for the vendor community, your expectations for innovation and supporting some of that innovation internally within your network. You know, there's been a lot of discussions around the ability to virtualize various functions of the network. Would love to hear your take on the opportunity set, particularly given your experience in transforming some of AT&T's own IT systems
yeah.
to the cloud and some of the experience you've had with some of your prior roles.
Yeah. So before I joined AT&T, at my prior company, we there was no such thing as the cloud. And, you know, we sort of architecturally looked at things and said, wouldn't it be a better scalable model if the software could run across any of the hardware? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we wrestled with that problem, and we wrote some proprietary interfaces and all that stuff. And I remember, like it was yesterday, going in to explain to the board that our operations model was we took a cart full of popcorn servers, we called them back then, mm-hmm. commodity servers, and we went up and down the aisles, and if the lights were out, then we pulled it out, and then we put a new one in, and if the lights went on, then we were good, and we moved to the next one. And so we separated reliability and cost of the hardware and the software. And so when I joined AT&T in 2008, it was a view that, you know, there's the world is going to march down this path. And at that time, before I joined, we had done what I'll call proprietary deployment, but it worked, and it worked at large scale. So then we came in, and we started re-architecting in around 2009, 2010. And then in our IT shop, we took a posture that we were going to be the most aggressive cloud company in the world, and we were going to take our enterprise applications, the target applications, 1,300 of them, and we're going to march 100% of them to the cloud. Now you'd say, well, that's not only ambitious, it's stupid. Well, that's true, but at a large scale, you're better off with the exceptions falling out and dealing with them, right, than allowing the debate. And so we're now, we've crossed over 40% of our entire enterprise entirely cloud-based. We've ported over mainframe applications that were over 40 years old into the cloud. And the economics are as good or better than we modeled, and we're getting very good at it. Now you'd say, well, surely that can't be the same as the wide area network, and the answer is yes, it can be. And so now we're in the process of doing designs for the customer-facing network to take it entirely into a cloud-based architecture. But it's a game changer because you deploy software instead of appliances. Your test cycles go from 18 months to 18 minutes. You provision the stuff directly with the customer. You can put the definition in the hands of the customer. And so it's not a theoretical exercise. It's actually stuff, you know, it's playbook stuff. It's stuff that is tangible and real and projects, and we're working our way through it. And so, to your point, we announced we called the program Domain 2. 5 years ago, we created a domain program where we narrowed the number of suppliers and we gave them hunting licenses in large spaces. And we said, we can't innovate, so just come and tell us what's a really good idea, and you'll be a partner, and we'll give you the information you need to give us, you know, groundbreaking sorts of change ideas. And they executed it probably as good or better than we did. We executed it, but it wasn't enough because it wasn't software defined. And so now we're doing the same thing with Domain 2, is saying to the suppliers, you know, we want you to come and challenge us. But the difference now is we're saying we want a disruptor in every space. We want a company that was born as a software company in every space so that we don't get tied down to a hardware-centric view of the world. And so the whole game changes. The game changes because in the lives of call centers and technicians, in how we engineer and how reliability is done, how the network is managed, when you get into this cloud-based architecture. I mentioned earlier our technicians, you know, our technicians, when they go out in the field and they get their tablet-based solutions, they're smart systems that are running all of these analytics and then producing them a really simple process. In the olden days, not only do we have to go through a bargaining process to do massive process changes, but then we had to go through big training courses and all that kind of stuff, and now the tablet just gives them a different protocol, and boom, they're done. So it really is changing a lot of the dimensions of our business.
And so in thinking about that, I guess, multi-tiered impact to the business, you know, what type of efficiencies have you seen from a cost perspective on the IT side of the house, and you know, do you expect that type of efficiencies or savings to be able to translate onto the wide area network?
Well, if you look at the business case of change, it varies a little across platforms, but let's say nothing is less than 30% more efficient on a per packet basis. Mm-hmm. And most of them are over 50% more efficient to do it this way. You take a lot more volume, so you, in some respects, you compound Moore's law. So you still ride the hardware curve, but also you can do a lot more things in software. So if you look at IT, to do the same work as last year, you know, we were always very good. You know, we would acquire a company, rationalize a number of applications, and IT shop would get more efficient, and we would be 4 or 5% year-over-year productivity, and now that number nearly doubles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, without even getting deep into this. So it's profound. It really is a big deal. So we I mean, and internally we talk about it as we're really becoming a software company. So late last year, within my organization, we organized as a software company.
Mm-hmm.
We got out of this tradition of IT and network.
And one, is it underappreciated the type of changes in cost efficiencies that can be driven out by an operational perspective once you implement this type of technology into the network? Like you mentioned, certain business processes effectively become redundant and much quicker.
Yeah, there will be efficiencies from it, certainly. And, you know, I hesitate to, you know, drop a number that someone can, you know, run into a spreadsheet. But because there's also this volume explosion. So underneath, you know, some lines that if you were to take the cells in your spreadsheet and draw a line and, you know, they move rather slowly, underneath that, there are massive migrations. I mean, right now, the enterprise is moving to the cloud. Just starting into that has caused a lot of TDM to copper to fiber, TDM to Ethernet, Ethernet speed ups. And so there's a tremendous migration underway right now inside the enterprises. If you look at the consumer side of the business, we talked about video and applications and those kinds of things. So there's a lot of activity underneath, but for the same unit of work as last year, we are materially faster.
Mm-hmm.
And we are materially less expensive for the same type of work. And so if at the end of the day that manifests into, you know, price changes that are happening very fast in the marketplace, that we're more responsive, that we can have customer program the network themselves, you know, it doesn't take a lot to realize that there'll be some efficiencies from it.
And then, you know, lastly on this topic, you know, since announcing the initiative, I mean, certainly there's been a flurry of activity from a vendor perspective and sort of from an innovation perspective. As you stand today, from what you've seen, the receptivity from some of your suppliers, are you increasingly optimistic about the opportunity set for making this sort of type of transition from your network? Or are you, you know, are you focused, you know, do you believe that the goals for making this type of transition are achievable right now based on the innovation that you've seen out there?
Yeah, I do. I think that there's a, you know, there's an anxiety curve.
Mm-hmm.
That companies will go through, and well, it's probably, you know, more like grieving, and it's just like, you know, denial and anger and then acceptance. I think we're in the acceptance part because we're down to really tactical planning activities.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I've been very impressed with the responsiveness once I think people got their heads around how do they execute a model where they're selling us software instead of these big complex appliances.
Mm-hmm.
That they've, in some cases, for decades have been building and engineering. And there's just a whole bunch of different changes in roles, too. Like, the reliability used to be done the following way, and you think about this, this probably will help underscore it for you. For certain services, we would have, well, for all services, we had some combination of card-level redundancy, shelf-level redundancy, system-level redundancy, and route-level redundancy. So with all of those, if we manage our network very well, we can get 45% utilization. A great software company can operate over top of you at 80% to 90% utilization. So we need to do that to ourselves so that owner's economics, maintained owner's economics, if you will. And so, you know, in order to do that, how you do reliability is fundamentally different. And so there's a change in responsibility between our supply chain and us as far as who's going to take responsibility for which elements of reliability, because more of it occurs now in software.
Excellent. And then I guess, you know, the last bucket that you mentioned was footprint expansion.
Yep.
And, you know, sort of making the decisions on where to attack certain white spaces, perhaps where to build out, you know, sort of additional footprint from both wireless and wireline perspective. You folks made an announcement. You're going to move a little bit further south than you had been in the past. And so, you know, how do we think about the opportunity set or the investment required in order to support various initiatives when it comes to footprint expansion?
Well, you know, a lot has been said and been written and been debated and been discussed as far as the efficacy of going south. So I won't talk about that. I'll stay in my domain of technology.
Right.
In the software-defined world, you know, getting an instance into a geographic extension tends to be a process that we're going to know how to do. We also are very good at moving onto target systems.
Right.
So in some respects, this is a lot more, it starts to look a lot more like an IT type of integration. And then, you know, on the network side of things, you know, that's what we do.
And in terms of the I guess the type of investment that's required to, you know, to ensure that you have the reliability and the brand that AT&T is bringing to the table, you know, is it a significant amount of investment? Is it, you know, a modest amount of investment? Is there a build versus buy argument that one could make for additional assets in order to improve network
quality? Well, in footprint, build versus buy is a lot more, I think, a lot more relevant. And the preference is always if you buy and you get the customers and the platforms are, you know, able to converge, then, you know, that certainly is a looks a lot more desirable than a build, and build has all the time to market implications. So certainly on footprint, that's the case. In some of the other investment areas, it isn't available to us. And inside of most carriers, a lot of the environment has become custom. So one of the things we work a lot on is trying to use more open source, get more standardization, get our systems aired out, more open, more API-based technologies, so that we can work in an environment where that legacy stuff, they aren't boat anchors.
But one would also imagine that, you know, the build versus buy decision also depends on the quality of the assets available, right? If they aren't, like you said, if they don't match quite right, if there is difficulty with integration, that perhaps is not something that, you know, from a network quality perspective, perhaps you folks will have the intention or the desire to make it, you know, of quality from the ground up. Is that an appropriate way to think about things?
Well, there's one thing, and it's the only thing positive about the early days of the iPhone, and, you know, I have a lot of scar tissue from that. But we have a lot of the organizational experience. And the second time through anything, you're going to be a lot faster and a lot smarter. So I think this whole process by which you take network quality and get it, take it from, you know, point A to point C or D, B, whatever, that we've gotten very good at that. I think we've gotten very good at knowing the trade-offs, where and how to plug holes, and then how to get capacity deployed. I frankly... hard thing to prove. I think we're world class, probably best in class at deployment cycle times as it relates to capacity and sites and so on. We've gotten extremely quicker from where we were a few years back.
Excellent. I guess, you know, as we come up on our time here, John, one last question, you know, from my side. If we look 5 years from now and we look at AT&T from a network technology perspective, where are we going to end up? What type of, you know, I mean, you mentioned increased amounts of software, increased amounts of efficiency, but what is the end goal here from your perspective on where you'd like to see sort of the network 5 years from now?
From a consumer perspective, prolific quantities of devices, addition and subtraction of those devices into your relationship with AT&T that's seamless and easy, self-service, a digital relationship with your network, a digital relationship with your technician, the ability to self-diagnose, self-dispatch. On the enterprise side, heavily embedded systems where we have system-level connections, not relationship-level connections, where it's highly automated, it's on demand. When the job is needed, the network's there. Security is attached to the network. Compute, storage, bandwidth, and security burst as one. I think you got a couple of folks here later today who will talk about some dimensions of that. And every technology company has to have a cloud strategy, and it's not how they virtualize, but how do they fit into this environment where the enterprise of the future will be, if not born in the cloud, they'll convert entirely to the cloud. And as a company internally, you know, we should be dealing with really hard problems personally, but everything else should be really digital. So I think the channels get transformed. I think the processes get transformed. I think the newer generation of customers who are digital natives are going to view this as like, what took you so long? And then, you know, but we have the full mass market out there. We also have customers who call us twice a month to ask questions about their bill, and then you sort of do a profile and find out that, you know, they're average, you know, they're retired, they're single, and then you realize they're calling you for the relationship, not for the information. So, you know, we have to accommodate that full range of customer base, and so that's sort of how I see it unfolding.
Well, fantastic, John. Well, best of luck in
Thanks.
Making that happen, and thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Amir.
Excellent.